Chapter 14, Resisting Indoctrination. Schmidt begins with two quotes, one from a former graduate student and one from a former cult indoctrinator. The graduate student said, "The professors were egotistical bastards who tried to impose their perspectives on others. In class, most of them didn't even pretend to want the student to have input. It was like, boom, boom, boom. These are the points. Class is done after I'm done talking." And from the former cult indoctrinator, "I, as the instructor, would say, save your questions until the end of the last session of the course, because if you have a question now, it will probably be answered in some later session. That's the first thing the group controlled, that you're not allowed to ask questions." And recruits would go, "Well, yeah, it's probably going to be answered better in the class." And that was a quote from a former cult indoctrinator. And Schmidt writes, "The strange idea that cult indoctrination might shed light on professional training emerged from my interviews with students. Many of their experiences in graduate and professional school sounded like what goes on in organizations that are accused of brainwashing their members into unthinking clones. Here I am referring to groups that demand total and therefore unquestioning commitment, which of course amounts to complete subordination. Such totalist organizations include military boot camp, gangs, some prison programs, and cults of all types, religious, New Age, human potential, self-help, self-awareness, psychology, therapy, health nutrition, personality, political, commercial sales, and so on. Most organizations in today's society, of course, are not totalist. Organizations ranging from corporations to mainstream unions are hierarchical and undemocratic. But they don't expect to control the totality of their employees' or members' lives. In other words, they are authoritarian, not totalitarian. But it is the totalitarian organizations that give insight into professional training. And so they are the focus of this chapter. One might not expect organizations as different as the Unification Church and the U.S. Marine Corps to have much in common. But rank-and-file Moonies and Marines are the same in one important way. They are not distracted by ideas of their own. In fact, all groups of the type listed above seek to produce such ideologically subordinate beings, who of course make obedient followers. When groups have ends that are the same in such an important way, we shouldn't be surprised to find that their means are the same in important ways, too. Indeed, according to the psychology and anti-cult literature, the same psychological themes dominate life in all groups that, quote, brainwash their members. Professional training programs feature these same themes of obedience and subordination. In this chapter, I describe the themes, which can be boiled down to a list of 8. Like a cult or other totalist organization, a given professional training program will feature most of these themes, but rarely all 8 of them. The particular subset varies from one totalist organization to another, and from one professional training program to another. Each theme can manifest itself in a variety of ways, and I quote former students to illustrate at least one manifestation of each in professional training. Readers will surely be able to fill in other examples. For example, in a totalist organization, we see Note 3, which describes U.S. Marine Corps Basic Training Camp, a single organization that features all 8 themes. The themes operate simultaneously and complement one another. They constitute a system, and so readers will find evidence of more than one theme in each of the quotes below. But am I claiming too much? Is the typical university program really as repressive and subordinating as a cult? My answer is, yes, it is, but not so for all students. students in the same program experience different degrees of subordination. Some students live in fear and work like slaves, while others enjoy a taste of autonomy and set their own pace. Each student negotiates his or her own deal. The same negotiation goes on in cults. But students are in a stronger position than cult members to resist subordination. They can organize, for example, and so students end up with a greater variety of levels of subordination than do cult members. Thus, I do not argue that professional training is always the same as cult indoctrination. Rather, I argue that life in graduate or professional school can be very much like life in a cult, and that for students who aren't careful, it will be. Of course, a few faculty members are exceptions to the rule and support students who resist the strong pressure to conform. Unfortunately, because professors themselves are a product of the selective system of weeding out and transformation that they now operate, faculty members who refuse to get with the program are few and far between. They can usually be identified by their participation with student activists in struggles against university authorities, and by their own tenure battles. Just because professional training programs are structured like brainwashing schemes does not at all mean you should stay away from them, for you can defeat their subordinating features and achieve the opposite of the usual outcome. Graduate or professional school can be fun and fulfilling, or arduous and alienating, depending in part on how you handle it. For me, it was the former. Graduate school amounted to getting paid to pursue my own interests. I learned some more physics, taught undergraduates as a teaching assistant, did research, audited interesting classes outside the department, did a lot of work with other activists, basically had a great and rewarding time. Yet for many other students in the very same program, graduate school was unrelentingly stressful. They emerged looking and acting like broken versions of their former selves. Graduate or professional school can enlighten and empower you personally and boost your self-confidence and self-respect. But that is not its purpose. And so these things will not happen automatically. In fact, the process of readying you to play a subordinate role at work acts against such goals. However, students who understand the subordinating themes that pervade the training environment can resist subordination and make their professional training a transforming experience in the positive sense of the term. Thus my purpose in describing the features common to all brainwashing schemes is to help immunize students against them. Simple awareness of how indoctrination systems work is a big step toward undermining their effectiveness. As psychiatry professor Louis Jolyon West noted in a report about training Air Force flight crews to resist brainwashing as prisoners of war, a realistic, undistorted, truthful account of what a man can expect constitutes a major protection for him. Close quote. Familiarity with the subordinating measures reduces unreasonable fears, opening the door to resistance. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System that Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000. We're in Chapter 14, titled Resisting Indoctrination, and going on to the next subsection of the chapter, which is titled Brainwashing and Resistance. Brainwashing, also known as coercive persuasion, thought reform, mind control, and menticide, might jokingly be defined as activity that persuades people to adopt beliefs that you don't like. Indeed, people are more likely to label an activity brainwashing if they don't like the beliefs it advances. However, if one has a clear definition of the word, then one can both avoid name-calling when a process isn't brainwashing and confidently say that's brainwashing when it really is. I use the word brainwashing to mean activity that pushes people toward unquestioning acceptance of any ideas and away from critical thinking. Brainwashing, then, is the opposite of education, which is activity that develops a person's critical faculties. Why choose critical thinking as the litmus test for brainwashing? Because it is what makes a human being an individual. People are individuals biologically, of course, but they are individuals socially only if they maintain an independent perspective. And doing this is an ongoing creative process based on critical thinking. And why is it so important that people be individuals? Because the thinking that people do when they create their own ideology, their own vision for society, is broader than the thinking involved in following a perspective that is given. The demands of this intellectual independence make individuals savvier thinkers, and therefore the best able to take care of themselves, serve others, and work for a better society. Because of their broader perspective, individuals make better personal decisions and take better advantage of whatever opportunities arise. And ironically, true individuals are the only people strong enough to overcome individualism, the self-centered orientation encouraged by those who favor the status quo. They alone have the strength to place unity above self and to work effectively for the good of the community. Only individuals, working together, can stand up to the forces of the status quo and make the world a better place. Any social movement populated by brainwashed followers is inherently weak and will eventually fail, for two reasons. First, the movement's leaders aren't always around, and dependent thinkers have difficulty taking initiative on their own. They can't seize opportunity because they don't have the creativity to even recognize it. And when their leaders show it to them, they can't do the creative thinking, innovation, and on-the-spot decision-making necessary to make the most of it. Second, a movement of dependent thinkers is easily disabled. One need only take out the leaders, or more typically co-opt them, and the faithful will be neutralized en masse. All groups that brainwash their members use the same basic process. They simultaneously break down the recruit's existing identity and rebuild the person as a follower. Any system working toward that end will have many of the eight features listed below. Robert J. Lifton's classic study of brainwashing, thought reform, and the psychology of totalism provided the basis for this list, to which I've added items 1 and 7. Learning to accept a totally subordinate role is the unifying theme of the eight features. To illustrate a few of the many ways in which the features manifest themselves in professional training, I've included first-person accounts from former students. I deliberately selected 4 people who made it through professional training with their values mostly intact, and they describe some of the steps they took to accomplish that. Ian, Rod, and John are sociologists, and Ted is a physicist. But the kinds of problems they faced occur in every field. For their protection, I'm not using their real names. Examples of the 8 subordinating themes and of resistance to them could come just as easily from professional training in law, psychology, history, medicine, or any other field. Number 1. Big promises. People do not let organizations take charge of their lives and change their personal identity unless they are dissatisfied with who they are and desperate to do something about it. Totalist organizations offer a new and appealing identity, that of a self-actualized person doing work of supreme importance. Desire for the promised new identity motivates the recruit to go through the difficult and abusive process of conversion. The new you will do big things for yourself and for the world. become a disciple of Jesus Christ and evangelize the entire world within this generation. The International Churches of Christ, formerly the Boston Church of Christ. Or, foster economic and scientific progress, the republican form of government, and the inalienable right to life for all people, the Lyndon LaRouche movement, or enrich your life with a higher understanding of truth, the divine principle, and find true love and lasting solutions to the social and national problems facing the world today, the Unification Church, or clear your mind of the impediments that prevent you from realizing your true potential, and thereby help clear the world of war, pollution, mental illness, illiteracy, drugs, and crime, the Church of Scientology. Or, step beyond the limits of your identity, break through to new levels of performance and ability in every area of your life, the Forum, formerly Erhard Seminars Training, or EST. Or, be all that you can be, defend the nation, the U.S. Army. Or, realize your true spiritual self beyond your body and thereby free yourself from anxiety, attain a state of pure, unending, blissful consciousness, and help free our society from conflict, the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, or the Hare Krishnas. And lastly, be saved and come to know the truth by studying the Word of God. Keep evil at bay and hasten the return of Jesus Christ by moving God's Word over the world. The Way International. Leaders of totalist organizations claim to be breaking with tradition. Indeed, their groups appear to be very different from the spiritless, missionless organizations that make the mainstream so unappealing. However, beneath its novel and innovative surface, the totalist organization is ultra-traditional and ultra-conservative, often to the point of being feudalistic. Typical features include an unelected leader whose decisions can't be appealed, exploitative practices that often amount to de facto servitude, a traditional repressive personal moral code followed obsessively by members and violated grossly by leaders, and a military-style hierarchy of sub-leaders appointed from above. Another way in which totalist organizations appeal to people is by offering an immediate benefit community. Life in today's alienating and atomizing society leaves people searching for meaning and longing to belong. Many groups love bomb disconnected and lonely people, giving them a sense of belonging. This deceptive recruiting technique begins with a disingenuous friendliness, a flirtatious style of talking, touching, hugging, kissing, flattery. Next come group activities in which doubt and critical thinking feel out of place. Singing, chanting, recitation, prayer, rituals, games. Swept away, recruits find themselves with an instant family-like community that seems too good to be true. Indeed, it is a false community, and any member who tries to have a say in how it is run, or who stops giving money or free labor, is out. In an undemocratic organization, the price of belonging is one's individuality. Lack of solidarity is another sign that the community is artificial. When a dispute arises between a member and a leader, fellow members don't come forward with support, nor do members band together to empower themselves within the organization. Rather, they compete to subordinate themselves to the leaders, angling to gain security that way. As the recruit gets more and more attached to their new family, the group's leaders gain an increasingly powerful tool for controlling their behavior, the threat of loss of community. Any threat of exclusion from the community terrifies the member with the prospect of personal annihilation, because the member now draws his or her identity and very sense of being exclusively from the group. Thus, shunning or shaming or humiliation is stronger than the loss of privileges as sanction for deviance from group norms. Likewise, praise from group leaders becomes inordinately important to the member and more effective than material payment as a reward for conformity. Peers cheer recruits on and praise them whenever they take a step toward total commitment. I added big promises to Lifton's list to emphasize that people who submit themselves to mind control organizations typically do so voluntarily, contrary to the popular image of how brainwashing works. Recruits take an active part in the process that leads to their conversion. Becoming a full member of the group is seen as a tremendous personal achievement and is marked by celebration. In his novel One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Ken Kesey draws attention to the common yet surprising phenomenon of voluntary submission to abusive systems of personal change. Recall that the story's main character, R.P. McMurphy, is incredulous when he discovers that almost all of his fellow inmates in the totalitarian psychiatric hospital are there by choice. Joining a totalist organization is a kind of self-institutionalization. It provides a refuge from a frightening world, time to gain strength, and the encouraging illusion of holding one's own in society. Of course, just because you join a totalist organization voluntarily doesn't mean the organization won't change you in ways you wouldn't have expected and wouldn't have wanted. Voluntary psychosurgery and shock treatment are apt analogies in this regard. At best, the organization's brainwashing-like hypnosis will take you only as far as you were initially willing to go, but there are no guarantees. Submitting yourself to a totalist organization to cash in on its promise of a better life is risky business, because ironically, the group will attempt to assault your identity, disempower you, and make you less of an individual. Ian went through the master's degree program in sociology at a large university in Ohio, and went on to the PhD program in social work there. He told me about the promise and the reality of sociology graduate school. And this is Ian's testimony. I was really excited when I entered graduate school. I was going to get a better theoretical understanding of the world, knowledge and research skills that could be applied in social activism. U.S. foreign policy was one of my major concerns. As an undergrad, I had been active in opposing U.S. support for the Contras in Nicaragua. But also, I saw a lot of domestic problems and was concerned about poverty and the polarization of the United States along economic lines. Before I entered the sociology program, I talked to some of the professors and to the chair of the department. They gave me a message that was close to what I wanted. They said, "We've got great resources here. We've got all these scholars with all these different perspectives. You can find your own niche," and so on. The thing that really stood out in my mind was the brochure they sent me. When you opened it up, there was a picture of a student sitting underneath a tree with a professor engaged in conversation. That's my first image of the department. I'm thinking, oh, great, there's going to be this informal exchange of ideas. I had this image of professors, that they're wholly committed to knowledge and understanding, and aren't that concerned about salaries and status. You know, you speak the truth. But once I got there, there was no pretense anymore. I recognized the student from the brochure, and he told me the picture had been staged. Professors didn't even pretend to do anything like Socrates sitting with students. They weren't open to different perspectives. It was, "This is the way you do research, and any other way is improper." I felt an imposition from day one. They didn't talk about people. They talked about respondents to surveys. And they never once mentioned anything about community involvement. What I saw was just a lot of careerism. Faculty members worked to pump out articles in accord with the canon that they could get them published in mainstream journals. They would talk about how you could turn one article into 15 and sneak them by. No one even spoke about working for social change. That was far from their minds. Many graduate students quickly left the program or adapted to the crass careerist perspective. I stayed but didn't adapt, and so I experienced a lot of conflict. For example, I was in a statistics class and I raised a question about the philosophical basis behind t-tests. It was simple stats, but I wanted to know the basis for the assumption that humans work the same way as the objects of study in hard sciences. Basically, the instructor said, "Well, I can't answer that. We're just here to learn the techniques." About a week later, I was in the elevator and met the student who had won the Student of the Year award. She had heard through the grapevine about my questioning and said to me straightforwardly, "People like you don't make it here." I said, "What do you mean, people like me?" She said, "Qualitative researchers who ask all these questions." Then she just stepped out of the elevator and walked off without waiting for my response. She is now a professor at some Big Ten school. Incidents like that really made me see that students were lined up with different professors, trying to get their little assistantships and their research grants and so on. They weren't a unified front. They were the opposite of that. That bothered me. It wasn't like we were sitting together and saying, "Well, okay, they're full of sh**, but we gotta go through, so let's cooperate to get through." The department chair ran a pro-seminar class for first-year students. In our first meeting, the professor told us the tricks of the trade. He told us how to pad our vitae. He made comments like, "Controversial work is hard to publish," and "Find projects that don't require much time." He sounded like a crass efficiency buffoon. Issues of quality were skirted through the entire quarter. Students would ask a lot of questions like, "So our whole goal is just to write articles for journals?" Basically, the response was, "There are only 5 good journals in sociology. You want to publish in those. And you're right. That's all your work in sociology is." Someone would ask, "What about teaching? Or what about community work?" "Well, you can throw that in, but that's not really what matters." This was only the first quarter, and I'm getting all of these messages, and I'm thinking I'm about ready to quit. But I didn't quit. I think one of the reasons was that I didn't see any alternative spaces where I could go. I had my whole identity with it. Without seeing anything better, I stuck it out. While sticking it out, Ian did things that kept his values alive. Continuing with Ian's testimony, "I don't know if I would have made it if I hadn't found like-minded friends in other departments. We had an informal group where we would discuss ideas and readings in much greater depth than in class, and we would edit each other's papers. I could get help from them, and there wasn't any catch in it. This group was very important to me." In my own department, 2 other students and I organized the graduate students around a departmental issue, and this created an atmosphere of solidarity. Students were upset that not everyone got financial support. The teaching and research assistantships were given out by a mysterious ABC ranking of students. A rank people automatically got funding. B was like maybe. C meant probably not. Several of the students, including me, started asking, "What's the criteria?" Finally, we got a meeting with the head of the graduate program. One of the 40 or so angry students at the meeting asked why the department had all this money for computers, but not enough for students. The professor answered that the department couldn't do anything about that, because the money comes in chunks designated for specific purposes. I thought, "Well, let's look this up," and I did. And at our next meeting of graduate students, I presented information indicating that he was lying. Everyone at the meeting was getting all pissed off. We were going, yeah, maybe we'll go on strike. We were really working together. But then one of the students who was in the A group raised his hand and said, I don't know if I can be a part of this organization anymore, because it sounds like we're going to have a tyranny of the majority. He was thinking that if we challenged the way funding was done, he was going to lose his. He got up and left, just walked out, but no one else did. We decided that instead of going to the chair, we would go out and make this a public event. We organized an 8-hour rally with leaflets, petitions, signs, and people with megaphones. Almost all of the participants were women. We pretended that this was what the department had told us was true, and that undergraduate education was suffering because the state and university weren't providing enough money for teaching assistants. We used the sociology department only as an example. TV, radio, newspapers, they all came out. They talked to us and then went and talked to the sociology department. The chair was scared shitless. Mysteriously, a week later, we found a memo in our mailboxes saying that everyone got funding. It was great to work together, and we ended up creating a small, ongoing coalition of students within the department. Ian's participation in the study group and student organization, both of which were independent of his university department, allowed him to experience some of the free intellectual development and fair treatment that the university promises but doesn't automatically deliver. His experience illustrates how a university graduate program, like any other organization whose real priority is to get people to play a subordinate role, keeps its recruiting promises only to the extent that it is forced to do so. Totalist organizations establish considerable control over their members' social environment and time. They undermine sources of social support outside the group, abridging members' contact with family, friends, and anyone else who does not share the group's attitude. They may foster economic dependence on the group. In any case, they isolate members from the outside world and often encourage or require them to live or socialize only with other group members. Privacy and the opportunity for reflection it provides is reduced. Communication is highly controlled. The organization influences what its members see, hear, read, and experience. People in this managed milieu become detached from society, socially isolated and lacking outside references. They lose their ability to make reality checks, judge circumstances independently, and therefore maintain a unique identity. The group becomes their dominant source of reality, and they adopt behavior and beliefs that make sense within that reality. The controlled environment, by design, produces a narrow, intense focus on work. Members put in long hours for little or no pay, by limiting the opportunity for critical thinking. The all-consuming activity facilitates indoctrination into the group's beliefs and the rules of behavior. For example, recruits are typically expected to assimilate large amounts of the group's written material quickly, which precludes critical examination and therefore amounts to indoctrination. The group's exploitative demands have consequences that further limit the member's ability to contemplate the big picture and notice personal change. An exhausting schedule, sleep deprivation, often poor nutrition, and eventually physical and psychological deterioration. The group maintains a strong barrier between members and outsiders. Members-only meetings and rituals reinforce this. When talking with outsiders, members are often secretive or deliberately vague about what they believe and about what goes on inside the group. Members act this way not just to protect the group's deceptive recruiting practices, but also because they are not confident that they can make their beliefs and activities sound reasonable to outsiders. They look enthusiastically to charismatic group leaders to do that. Members remain in their own world, even when they interact with outsiders, as they must when selling or recruiting or engaging in normal everyday activity. An encounter with a member may at first seem to be a genuine two-way interaction, but the member has a hidden superior attitude and the single goal of advancing the group's doctrine, and so remains personally unaffected by the interaction. Rod is a sociologist trained at Louisiana State University in Baton Rouge. He told me how the structure of the PhD program there favored an uncritical approach. Reading assignments of 300 to 400 pages per week per seminar were normal, and frequently they went far beyond that. Add to this the weekly writing assignments, usually done under such a timeline that little critical thinking was possible. This structure ensured the hegemony of orthodoxy. I spent from 8 a.m. till 10 p.m. in the office and in seminars, then home or to the library to read and write until 2 or 3 a.m. Needless to say, I drank a lot of coffee during this time, and the pressures took a big toll on my marriage. Despite the pressure, Rod took action to stay in charge of his perspective. The development of informal grad student groups actually was one of the few areas in which discussion could go beyond the strict orthodoxy. I organized a reading group which included graduate students and young faculty members who were more politically progressive than older faculty members. About 10 of us would pick a book to read and then get together in someone's home for several nights of discussion and debate. This proved to be quite fruitful for those of us taking part in it. Unfortunately, the group became a point of contention with senior faculty members, who felt it was keeping some of the best students from working with them. The sheer workload of graduate school leads to social isolation and limits the opportunity to explore new lines of thought. However, members of Rod's reading group consciously appropriated some very scarce time, put it outside the control of the department, and used it to think in unprescribed directions. Point number 3. Unquestioned authority. The self-appointed leaders of totalist organizations claim they deserve special respect and authority for any number of reasons. They have achieved the highest level of enlightenment. They understand the governing principles of society, life, or the cosmos. They have been chosen by God. They have the gift of prophecy. They have the greatest dedication to the cause, and so on. Members, in turn, trust that the seemingly mysterious dictates of the leaders come out of the leaders' deeper understanding of the world and further a higher purpose, the same purpose that members have signed on to further. Willing subjects of this mystical manipulation are reminiscent of children, and like children, they are vulnerable to abuse. Totalist organizations are authoritarian because a total commitment precludes questioning, and without questioning, an organization can have no internal mechanism that limits its leaders' use or abuse of authority. Clearly, then, a totalist organization cannot be democratic. Members do not choose and cannot fire the leaders of the organization that directs their lives. Authority is centralized, orders work their way down from above, and leaders at no level tolerate dissent. Anyone whose dissent threatens to influence the thinking of other members is quickly removed from the group. Leaders of totalist organizations treat their own power as more important than the group's mission, even though the mission is supposedly of overriding importance. Thus, they often squelch members who take initiative on their own and organize people to advance in some way the stated mission of the organization. The leaders would rather have total control of a group that does a poor job of fulfilling its all-important mission than be rank-and-file members of a democratic but more effective organization. The people who run totalist organizations are personally intimidating figures and frightening to challenge. Members try to anticipate their wishes and scurry to fulfill those wishes, even before the leaders express them. John is a sociologist who went through graduate school at a Midwestern university. He told me about an incident that brought out how people felt about the faculty's authority, and this is John's testimony. One professor was a statistician who did a lot of research in spousal abuse. Unfortunately, I totally had a problem with both his methodology and his conclusion. He concluded that, in essence, it's just as likely for the woman in a relationship to be abusive towards the male as it is for the male to be abusive towards the female, which I have to say flies in the face of almost every other study on this issue, but he believed fervently that he could disprove them. He was almost zealot-like about it, you know, Don Quixote, on a mission from God and all that. Although I give him high marks for being concerned about his teaching and being conscientious, he was just as egotistical as the others, and he was just as arrogant about his approach. I mean, it wasn't just, this is a really cool way to go, but this was the, capital T-H-E, way to go. It's this or die. Well, one evening, some of the students put stickers on his picture. You know how departments will have on public display pictures of all the professors with their names and what kind of work they do? One sticker said, "This is offensive to women," and another said, "This is offensive to people of color." A friend of mine and I were up there studying, and we saw the stickers just after they were put on. We talked about taking them down, and felt like, no, somebody really wants to make this statement, we've got to let it stay. The professor took incredible offense, and boy, did it get ugly. I had no idea. I was probably naive. There was talk like, we know who did it. They must be thrown out of the department, when they had no clue who did it. That really conveyed like, how dare they defile the sacred temple? There was a real kind of almost theological overtone to the statements, how these people had defiled, how they had impugned the character of this righteous man. That was the reaction of most of the faculty, and the students who shared the mainstream orientation, which was most of the students. That orientation was toward quantitative methods. I was in the department's small program in studies of social conflict, which took a more qualitative approach to understanding. The general reaction to the incident was, this must be a conflict student. We must purge ourselves. In fact, within a year of the incident, the faculty had dismantled the conflict program. Despite the repressive environment, John took steps that allowed him to maintain an independent point of view. John continues, one of the best things I did in graduate school was to organize a brown bag lunch group that brought together about 8 graduate students with similar interests. This was invaluable. We talked about what was going on in the department and in the world, organized a reading group, initiated seminars, and helped bring speakers to campus. We complained about professors who had unreasonable expectations, professors who may have done things that we considered unethical and illegal. There is a great deal of exploitation of graduate student workers. We organized a couple of political actions inside and outside the department and wrote letters to campus and local newspapers about disputes inside the department and about campus-wide graduate student issues. The group was something that was positive about graduate school. We had to create it. It helped me to graduate in spite of many attempts by faculty to dissuade me out of getting a Ph.D. Professors can be personally intimidating figures that students fear to challenge. But as John discovered, creating an oppositional community changes that drastically by shifting the balance of power. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System That Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000. This is Chapter 14 on Resisting Indoctrination, going through the 8 qualities for recognizing a totalist organization. Guilt-tripping and shaming. The charismatic leaders who run totalist organizations are seen by members as superior human beings. This puts the leaders in a position to judge the members and make them feel guilty and ashamed for their morally tainted personal histories and current personal shortcomings. members are expected to adopt the position that they are not good enough human beings. The leaders spell out the model good person's behavior and use guilt and shame to push members in that direction. Thus, members feel that they are not living their lives in close enough accord with the official ideology, not studying that ideology hard enough or knowing it well enough, not working hard enough for the global, social, or personal change that the group is dedicated to bringing about, not giving up the sins of their former lifestyle, not recruiting enough, not selling enough, not raising enough money, or in one way or another not showing sufficient commitment to the group's vital work. Guilt-ridden members hostily denounce the outside influences that prevent them from getting with the program totally. Ian, the student who went through the master's degree program in sociology at Ohio University, told me about one professor's attempts to make him feel unworthy and how he overcame them. Ian's testimony. The professor who ran my seminar class on political sociology had a pretty big name, and his head was even bigger. One day he was arguing that the level of education was the best measure of social class. I said I thought occupation was better. We debated it back and forth for about 5 minutes. But then he started saying, "Have you read this book? Have you read that book?" Finally he said, "See me after class." His voice was fluctuating and he was like, "Oh my God." So I met him in his office right after class, and he closes the door and says, "I've never had such an obstinate student in my whole life. I don't think you should be in sociology." I said, "I didn't mean to be obstinate, but you know, there are different ways of doing things." He said, "No, you just do not have the right persona to be a sociologist." I got really quite upset. I felt like, what am I going to do, stand here and prove that I'm a good human being? Say, yes, I really can act like a sociologist? I didn't know what to do, so I left his office. Later in that class, he assigned me a tricky research project. I knew it was a setup, but I took it and said to myself, "I'm going to prove this motherfucker wrong. I'm going to go out there and write the best paper." He gave me a B on it. He wrote that I showed good library research skills, but didn't think out the premise. I took that to mean, you work hard, but you can't think. I was so upset that I jumped on the bus and went out to the country to get away from the university and the city. I was walking around and this cow came up, and I gave my paper to the cow. And the cow ate it. I took the staple out, and the cow ate the whole paper. I think a lot of us who have these problems do symbolic things to fight back. The cow ate the professor's comments as well. I was hoping it wouldn't kill her. In spite of my anger, there was a lot of self-blame. I left Ohio and went back home, supposedly to write my master's thesis. My family treated me as if I were still a good human being, but I did nothing for 6 months. Then I got involved with the Persian Gulf War protests and decided to do my thesis on that. There was this transformation when all of a sudden I got connected. I found an alternative community away from the university. They were street intellectuals. Articulate people who really cared and knew much more about the world than all these highly formally educated folks. Integrating my community organizing with my research allowed me to write a thesis that I could be proud of. I did the interviews and drafted the thesis within 4 months. I took it back to Ohio and said, "You're going to pass this. But in return, I won't apply for your PhD program." They read it and gave me the master's degree. Later, I entered the PhD program in social work and did my dissertation on another aspect of the anti-war protests. By connecting to an oppositional community, the street intellectuals, Ian gained a real and independent source of self-worth. This limited the university's ability to lower his opinion of himself. and I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System That Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000, in Chapter 14, which is titled Resisting Indoctrination. And going on with the next of the 8 points of the Totalist Organization, this is point number 5, Total Personal Exposure. Totalist organizations push their members to reveal everything possible about themselves, their personal relationships, activities, thoughts, likes, dislikes, personal goals, and plans. The tacit understanding is that each member is property of the group. Within the Totalist organization, having independent memory, emotion, imagination, or aspiration is seen as selfish and highly immoral. Personal activities or plans that don't give priority to the group are viewed with suspicion. The group dictates, sometimes in great detail, how members should think, act, and feel. It may prescribe what type of clothes members wear. Group leaders make members' career and life decisions, whether to change jobs, get married, move to another city. In the environment of total exposure, guilt leads obviously to confession, which is a major activity in totalist organizations. Members admit sins and imperfections and describe the latest situation in which they were held back by their failure to put sufficient trust in the group's leaders or doctrine. In general, the actions or thoughts they confess boil down to failures to subordinate themselves to the organization or its stated ideology. The confession is an implied pledge of future subordination, and as such puts the member back in the good graces of the group's leaders. Members sometimes exaggerate their failures or weaknesses, or even confess to sins they haven't committed, as a convenient way of reaffirming their subordination. As recruits become more open with the group and begin to confess all to leaders, they become less open with outsiders, including family and friends. Because they can't fully share with outsiders the most important activity in their lives, and because they don't offer much in the way of individuality, members of totalist groups have difficulty forming emotionally intimate relationships with people outside the organization. Even a close relationship between two members is limited in depth, because every member's most intimate relationship is with the organization. At meetings, the group focuses in turn on each member's case. The upshot is that organizations that expect a total commitment are not only authoritarian but also totalitarian, because they do expect to control the totality of the member's life. Rod, the sociologist who went through graduate school at Louisiana State University, told me what some students did to limit the program's power over them. And this is Rod's testimony. There were graduate students who wouldn't say certain things about their personal lives around certain faculty. They'd seen enough of the politics and things that went on that they were wary of letting people know anything because it had the potential for political use. A fellow graduate student and very good friend of mine was a single parent. Being a graduate student is tough enough. Being a single parent is tough enough. But combining the two is almost an impossible task. Things happened to her that were devastating in her personal life. As she went through battles with her ex-husband, he showed up and took her son to visit with him for a couple of days in another state, and then called her and said, "Sorry, you're never going to see him again." You can imagine the kind of crisis that was for her, and it happened in the middle of a semester. But she didn't want me to mention this to faculty members. She said, "Let's keep this quiet. You know, don't let this be known. I don't need that." Faculty might have said, "Her biggest priority is making sure that her son is taken care of," or, "Being a good mother is not conducive to being a good scholar." I know that those kinds of things are said and are used against people in terms of getting tenure and everything else. She did get her son back, and she did get her PhD. She was part of our reading group and part of a small informal support group. Rod's fellow student knew the difference between sharing personal information with her friends, which can lead to support and bonding, and revealing personal information to people who want to keep her in a subordinate position, which can give those people added powers to do just that. Those who are more naive expect that sharing personal information with someone in charge will prompt that person to think on a one human being to another basis, putting aside his or her usual priority of furthering the organization's goal. That seldom happens. Point 6. Quote, scientific, unquote, dogma. You can't commit yourself totally to an organization if you have to look outside the group for help in understanding the world or finding your proper role in it. And you can't stay totally committed to a group unless you have a way to avoid genuinely grappling with the facts and ideas that challenge the group's practices. Totalist organizations solve both of these problems by giving you a dogma capable of explaining everything. Teachings that can make sense of everything call out not for improvement but for worship. Indeed, members of totalist organizations never question their group's basic doctrine, and therefore never push to improve it in any fundamental way. Yet the typical group boasts that its views are scientific. Sacred would be a more accurate description. As Lifton notes, the totalist organization demands reverence. For the originators of the Word, the present bearers of the Word and the Word itself. The group's doctrine, being sacred rather than scientific, is not subject to falsification. That is, it is a higher authority than experience. And indeed, such primacy of doctrine over person is a characteristic of totalist organizations. Members deny the validity, truth, and even reality of any experience that contradicts the doctrine, even their own personal experience. In this way, the doctrine maintains the group's subordinating presence in the lives of its members, even when the group's leaders are absent. A single charismatic individual or a small core of leaders has complete control over the group's doctrine and can change it at will. If the group professes to believe in an unchangeable set of writings, such as the Bible, then the elite dictates the group's interpretations of those writings. This interpretation will differ from all of the other groups that profess to follow the same writings. The group is ultimately ruled by a few individuals, not by principles, as its leaders claim. The existence of the sacred science helps to keep members in their place and maintain the hierarchy of power within the group. The group treats its teachings as unfathomable and always yielding new truths, especially in the hands of the leaders. Members give a person respect and authority in proportion to the person's facility with the all-explaining doctrine. This empowers leaders in the lives of members and disempowers others. Non-members, for example, are seen as pitifully unenlightened. As a result, non-members find that nothing they say, no matter how sensible, influences a member's thinking or actions. That is, they find members to be closed-minded. The group's leaders, on the other hand, automatically know the doctrine better than any member ever can, because what they say defines it. They are the only people more enlightened than the members, and so conveniently, they are the only people able to influence a member's thinking or actions. Because the doctrine's range of application is unlimited, those who know it best have authority in all areas of life, and presumably act out of the deepest understanding of the world. Hence, in totalist organizations, members do not criticize leaders, no matter what the issue. Scientific, quote-unquote, dogma always comes with a set of thought-terminating cliches, which help believers hide their closed-mindedness, mainly from themselves. Totalist organizations have their own language, an in-group lingo that allows members to describe the world in terms of all the groups explaining science, often by being prematurely abstract in their analysis. The thought-terminating cliché is one such premature abstraction. Thus, for example, war is the work of Satan, ends the potentially revealing debate about the politics of a particular war. Describing or merely labeling something using this language counts as understanding it, ending any need for further consideration. Hence, new points of view or troublesome events do not provoke reflection, but are quickly explained and dismissed. The jargon that expresses key concepts seems profoundly meaningful within the group, yet members cannot translate it into ordinary language to their own or anyone else's satisfaction. Being isolated from society, however, they are rarely called upon to do so. John, the sociologist who got his PhD at a Midwestern university, told me about the role of doctrine in the graduate program. This is John's testimony. The faculty saw the whole world through numbers. They were pretty rigid, statistical methodologists. They felt that quantitative methods could explain just about everything. The way I saw it, these methods are just a tool in someone's arsenal. I had an interest beyond the numbers and sought to understand society through a variety of tools and theories, including history and qualitative ethnographic research, in which the subjects speak for themselves. But the faculty really did not think of the world in terms of anything other than social relationships that could be explained via statistics. If you had conversations with these people, even on a personal level, it invariably became, what do the numbers show? What does the survey show? What does the polling information show? Is it statistically relevant? It gets to be difficult to just have a sane conversation with an individual who thinks like that because they don't turn it off. Within the faculty, people with a quantitative orientation carried more weight or had more prestige or more honor, what have you. They pretty much controlled the department. The chair, the graduate advisors, the people on the key committees were all quants. Quants represent a large fraction of the field as a whole, too. The faculty had a notion that, we are going to turn you into professional sociologists. And what a professional sociologist is this quantitative person. The area that you look at may vary somewhat, but your methodology and your general orientation should be this. They had an ideologically rigid notion of what sociology is about. And if you didn't do statistics, or if you didn't have a positivist framework, then in their minds you weren't a real sociologist. They had clear views on who was the superior person and student. They did everything they could to either encourage you to focus on stat methods or discourage you from getting your PhD. Their best applicants were interested in theory, interested in social conflict, interested in social movements. So they would encourage these students with non-quantitative interests to come in. They believed they could turn these people around, show them the light, as it were. Indeed, I saw several people switch majors or switch focus to have an easier time and fewer problems in graduate school. I saw people leave conflict to go to criminology or demography or stat methods. There was a favored orientation, a clear doctrine. John identified, understood, and critiqued the scientific dogma pushed by those in charge. By doing so, he pinpointed the origin of his conflicts with the powers that be and their followers. Had his conflicts bewildered him, it is unlikely he would have survived the program. Of course, not all departments within a field are the same, so students have some leeway to select less ideologically rigid programs. However, exercising this choice often means attending a less prestigious institution, which can have serious negative consequences for a career in the field. Point number 7, taking away true self-confidence. You can't become totally committed to an organization that you don't totally trust, and you can't trust an organization totally if there are occasions when you feel confident that your judgment is better than that of the group's decision makers, or that part of the group's doctrine is wrong. Hence, your self-confidence stands in the way of total commitment. Totalist organizations work to remove this obstacle. Leaders belittle members, usually by confronting them in areas where they feel insecure, in knowledge of the group's doctrine, for example, which one can never know deeply enough. Members end up with so little self-confidence that they trust the group, both its leaders and its doctrine, more than they trust themselves. As their time in the group increases, members become more and more confident when they are acting with the approval of group leaders or in accord with group doctrine, but less and less confident about taking initiative outside of that safe framework. They end up acting self-confident to the point of being arrogant or cocky, except where it matters most, in their dealings with the leaders of the group, the people who set their direction. Members check an increasing proportion of their life activities with group leaders. They become increasingly dependent upon the group, returning to a situation like that of the child under adult authority. This lack of true self-confidence causes members to ignore anomalies that challenge the group's doctrine. Whenever a world event or personal experience appears to contradict the organization's dogma, those without the self-confidence necessary to listen to their own intuition, let alone stand up to the leaders of the group, will discount their observations and stick to the doctrine. Members of totalist organizations show little spontaneity, imagination, creativity, or sense of humor, all of which grows out of self-confidence. Their lack of self-confidence also makes it difficult for them to leave the group. John told me what he saw graduate school do to the self-confidence of his fellow students, John said. Graduate school shook some. People felt like, gee, should I really be here? Some people had their self-concept challenged and their self-confidence at least questioned, if not challenged. Students with the right orientation ultimately had their self-confidence boosted. However, at the same time that these students got higher status and honor than someone like myself, they also learned that it's not a good idea to challenge the department chair or a committee member or a professor in class. There's a certain kind of deference that they learned at the university, a whole attitude of deference. It's probably a natural tendency among undergraduates that is reinforced in graduate school. I don't think they'd stand up to a big name. Whereas in a professional meeting I might say, I don't care how many more books you've written than me, I still have a problem with what you're saying. They would defer more to that individual's authority, that individual's perspective. John saw the system give people confidence in proportion to their adoption of dominant values and their willingness to play a subordinate role. This confidence, of course, is not the true self-confidence that John had to develop to survive as an independent thinker. And the last of the 8 points of the totalist organization, the only path to salvation. Every totalist organization claims to be committed to one or another mission of supreme human importance. And each group views the work it is doing as the most important work being done by anyone, anywhere. Furthermore, the totalist organization believes that no one else grasps the principles that are the key to achieving the vital, personal, and social goals to which the group is committed. Hence, the individual, and indeed humanity as a whole, is doomed without the group and its insights. Members, therefore, feel an enormous responsibility to spread the word and recruit, and to do so urgently. They feel that the group's mission is more important than their own lives, and so with encouragement from their leaders, many work like slaves, even though that takes a physical and psychological toll. At the same time, they are arrogant and elitist toward outsiders. From the perspective of the most extreme totalist organizations, those who reject the group's truth stand in the way of humanity's opportunity for true existence and thereby forfeit their own right to exist. This belief establishes a heavy atmosphere in the group. It justifies extreme measures, especially against those who leave the group. In the condemnatory atmosphere, insecure or guilt-ridden recruits are drawn to a conversion experience as a way of establishing their right to exist. Leaving the group is seen as a sign of personal weakness that will have disastrous personal consequences, such as the end to personal growth, reappearance of prior personal problems, social failure, failure to get ahead economically, or failure to survive looming big changes in the world. Ted is a physicist who got his PhD at a university in the Southwest. He told me about the arrogant attitude of members of a research group there. The group specialized in the subfield of elementary particle physics, or high-energy physics. Ted's testimony. Our department decided to start a high-energy physics program, which would have a close connection with the SSC, the Superconducting Super Collider Particle Accelerator, which Congress later canceled. They hired a fairly good high-energy guy and later two more. One of the first things the head of the new high-energy group did was arrange a meeting with the grad students to introduce himself and his program. It was supposed to be a friendly get-to-know-each-other meeting, and I'm sure he wanted to try to use it as a recruiting tool. At the meeting, the first thing he said was, "I am here to bring this department into the 20th century. Not the 21st, but the 20th. Wow, this ticked off a lot of faculty when they heard about it. We did not have a big department, but we did have people doing up-to-date research, including a good group of solid-state physicists. But the high-energy physics people respected no one but the other high-energy physics people. They thought that high-energy physics was where all the new physics was going to come from, and that people in the other subfields were on a futile search. The way the high-energy physics people talked to us definitely led us to believe that they felt superior. They took an arrogant approach to everything, from the curriculum to the PhD qualifying exam to tenure decisions, all of which they wanted to control. They always said, 'Let us decide. We know what's best for the department.'" This is a direct quote. Whether they knew what they were talking about or not, the high-energy people tried to stop almost every person who came up for tenure. One person they tried to stop was one of the best in a major subfield and brought in the most money to the department. Their thinking was, why give this person tenure when we could get someone better, say a high-energy person? Most of the new high-energy people were junior in rank. Yet they spoke their minds and told us how stupid we were. After insulting us, they asked us to help them support the SSC. They were almost in tears at times. And what was really funny, they did not have a clue as to how or why we were doing research in other fields. They always said, "What good is this?" They knew nothing about anything other than high-energy physics. Sheltered lives. Problems in the department weren't limited to the high-energy people. A lot of the faculty treated students unfairly and like children. They didn't respect us as human beings or as individuals. An extreme example was the abuse of Chinese students by Chinese faculty, who induced fear in their students and then made unethical demands on them. The department didn't stop even such extreme mistreatment. Despite the subordinating atmosphere, Ted took action that allowed him to maintain his dignity. Continuing with Ted's testimony. One day I said to myself, "What the hell? I've worked outside of school in the real world, and so I'm not going to be treated like a child." The straw that broke the camel's back was a relatively minor issue involving the department's seminar, which was a weekly talk attended by faculty and students. Students liked the spirit of the seminar, which was learning because you wanted to learn, and so we enjoyed hearing speakers from other institutions. This suddenly changed when an authoritarian faculty member became seminar coordinator and demanded that students write summaries of the talks. This did not go over well at all. So we, the students, decided to have a meeting of graduate students. We organized it and set a date. Word spread like wildfire, and soon the seminar coordinator was at our door, trying to head us off at the pass. He told us in no uncertain terms that he could do what he wanted with the course, and he wanted to come to our meeting. He was told that would be up to the students. The students said no. As the day of our meeting approached, pressure around the department started to show its ugly head. We learned later that a split in the faculty had developed. Some supported us 100% and wanted us to kick his butt, and others were amazed that we would even think of questioning a professor. No one acted openly to help us, but people did intervene to try to stop us. Some of the students got pressure from their advisors not to have anything to do with us. This united us more. At the meeting, we decided to fight the seminar and to form a physics graduate student union. The seminar coordinator told us not to threaten him. Some students caved in to the pressure and did what he asked, but our union took off. We elected a president, vice president, U.S. student representative, and foreign student representative. The union gave us an unofficial voice in the department and in how it was run. To keep us quiet on the seminar issue, the faculty pulled the new coordinator after just one semester, dropped the writing requirement, and even reduced pressure on students to attend. Ted's outside experience helped him see through the local powers that be. It helped him to imagine standing up to people feared by others and rejecting their totalist expectations. He could then take action. Here, then, in summary, is a list of symptoms of a totalist organization. Big promises, milieu control, unquestioned authority, guilt-tripping and shaming, total personal exposure, scientific quote-unquote dogma, taking away true self-confidence, the only path to salvation. Any organization that wants people to play an ideologically subordinate role, be it a professional training program, a cult, a military unit, or an employer, will use these techniques. But as we have seen, the organization doesn't always get what it wants. When any one of these subordinating features are present in an organization, intellectually honest people will recognize them easily. The hard part is mustering the courage to fight them. Hence, any successful resistance, such as that carried out by Ian, Rod, John, and Ted, should be publicized to inspire others. As we will see in the next chapter, even seemingly insignificant resistance can play a vitally important role in preserving one's identity. The four individuals quoted in this chapter are exceptional in that they survived professional training without adopting mainstream values. When I interviewed them, I discovered that all four had accomplished this in part by organizing and creating an alternative community. As we will see in the next chapter, this is not a coincidence.